Welcome, friends, to another edition of Economic Update, weekly program devoted to the economic dimensions of our lives, our incomes, our jobs, our debts, the futures for our kids, all of that. I'm your host, Richard Wolff. I've been a professor of economics all my adult life, and currently I teach at the New School University in New York City. Before jumping into today's program, opening September 2015, I want to make a couple of announcements. The first one is basically an invitation to everyone hearing this program. If you happen to be in New York City at any time during this coming year, please note that we do a monthly economic update in person at the historic Judson Memorial Church, downtown New York City and Washington Square, very famous and beautiful church. The second Wednesday of every month, I'm there starting at 7:30 to present an economic update in more detail than we have time for on this program, a chance for me to meet you and vice versa. The next one is this coming Wednesday, September 9th, 7:30 p.m., Judson Memorial Church, Washington Square, Manhattan. You are invited. And I also want to remind you that we have redecorated and re-inaugurated our website, rdwolf2fs.com, but even more, democracyatwork.info. It's to that latter one in particular that I would draw your attention. And if you do go and take a look at it, think about signing up for our newsletter. It's free. It's available to you all the time, more regularly in the months ahead than we have in the past. And so it's a way to keep up with everything that we do on this program, plus a good bit more. Okay, let's jump right in. I want to first mention a book that was released this last week, literally on September 1st, by the Houghton Mifflin Harcourt Publishing Company. It's called $2 a Day, Living on Almost Nothing in America. The author is a professor, indeed a very distinguished professor, at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore. Her name is Catherine Edin, E-D-I-N. And what she shows there is the stunning, as well as depressing, reality that we have millions, let me underscore that, millions of people in the United States, particularly children, living on less than $2 a day. Now, the reason we pick $2,000 a day, and Professor Edin does as well, is because it's the global standard for extreme poverty. It was developed by the World Bank to be used across the world. The idea that there are any such folks condemned to such a life in the United States, let alone that they number in the millions, makes this book an important milestone to note and a resource for those of you seriously interested in the problem of growing poverty in this economic system. The second short update I want to go over with you was the decision, also this last week, by a U.S. judge in a case brought by engineers against four high-tech companies in the United States. This case was filed back in 2011. We have commented upon it in this program on occasion. So with the final judge's decision this last week, I wanted to summarize it for you. The engineers worked for four companies. You've heard of them. Apple, Google, Intel, and Adobe Systems Incorporated. The judge found these companies and their chief executives guilty. Of what? Of conspiring with one another not to hire each other's engineers away. Effectively meaning that those engineers could not leave one company for a better paying job in another company because the companies had colluded, and that, by the way, is against the law, to prevent that. because it benefited all of those companies because it kept the salaries they paid to their engineers much lower than they would otherwise have been had those engineers been free to go for the highest pay they could find for the skills that they have. In particular, in this case, the really damning evidence was based largely on emails in which Apple co-founder Steve Jobs, former Google chief Eric Schmidt, and some of their rivals worked together to the damage of their engineers. That's how a profit-driven corporation works. This happens from time to time. My guess from everything I have studied is that it happens a lot. But these fellows got caught. Now, true, the $415 million settlement is not enough to make any difference to companies of the size of Apple and Google. It is a proverbial bump in the road. But it at least allows us to see what these folks, often celebrated for their entrepreneurship, what they actually do when it comes to working and quote-unquote succeeding in this economic system. As if this were a theme, let me go on to my next short update. It has to do with a movie, the trailer for which was released this last week. The movie itself will not be released for a while. The movie's name is Concussion. It stars the actor Will Smith. It got an unwelcome front page story in the New York Times on September 2nd when the reporter there, Ken Belson, basically unearthed a treasure trove of emails, thanks to WikiLeaks, hackers who had gotten into the, what shall we call it, mail of the Sony Corporation. The Sony Corporation is the producer and releaser of this film called Concussion. And here's what the story details. Back and forth communications between the National Football League and Sony Pictures, high executives in both of them. And the point and purpose of their exchange was to remove from the film unflattering, that's the word of Mr. Belson in the New York Times, unflattering moments for the NFL that were, and I love their use of this elaborate language, deleted, cut out, removed. What was the issue? The film is about a scientist who discovered that the NFL in its regular football games was subjecting its players to repeated concussions. That's a kind of brain injury. And that these had led to the development of a disease. It's called degenerative brain disease, known by the initials CTE. These are now known to cause death, often by suicide, dementia, and other extremely serious brain dysfunctions and diseases. The NFL has been involved in a long struggle with its players because, as the players alleged in a famous lawsuit, the league knew long time ago of this problem of concussions, dementia, suicide, death, but hid it in the interest of keeping up a highly profitable football franchise in the United States. Indeed, according to the New York Times story, the NFL is on schedule now to pay, quote, hundreds of millions of dollars to about 5,000 NFL players, past and present, who brought suit against the NFL. Once again, it's a bump in the road for the kinds of billions that these companies, and that's what they are, companies that run football games and football teams for profit. What's the message here? I'm not interested in the details of the case. We don't have the time for it anyway. But I'm interested in the punchline, and here it goes. If you allow your sports activities that millions of Americans enjoy and like to be run as profit-driven corporate businesses, you really can't be surprised if the primary goal of the people running this operation, namely profits, overcomes, overwhelms, subordinates, and neglects anything that might interfere with profits, like the injury and death of players. If you have private enterprise in sports, this is what you are going to get. It happens over and over again. Absent the profit motive, you might have seen an alarm bell go up long ago, trying to rework the game so that it does not involve such horrific consequences to its champion players. But profit is what makes capitalism go around. And if you don't want the results, you've got to question the system. Next, I want to spend a few minutes with you talking about Donald Trump. Now, of course, we do not endorse any candidate in this program. We do not do it, and we will not do it. But we are interested in the economics that are involved in one or another campaign. And when the economics are broadly interesting, we want to talk about them. And they are interesting in the case of Mr. Trump. So let's talk a little bit about that with a focus on answering the interesting question, why is he as popular as he is? Why is he the front runner among the candidates of a major party in this country? And so on. Let's go through it. Interesting economic aspects. First, Mr. Trump is a billionaire. You might imagine that all kinds of people who are not billionaires, who have a hard time making ends meet, would have a gut-level disinclination to support somebody so different from themselves. But that's clearly not the case. Large numbers of the supporters of Mr. Trump are clearly and obviously not rich people. But it goes beyond that. Mr. Trump regularly denounces his competitors, chief among them Jeb Bush, for being controlled and dominated by rich donors to their campaign. Mr. Trump gleefully explains that he's so rich, he doesn't have to depend on donors and be slavish toward them. This is an interesting comment by a billionaire on how the American political system works. You might expect that kind of critique from folks on the left. You might expect it from critics of the system. But here's someone who loves the system, clearly, because he says so, and his life clearly illustrates it, but one who's able, willing, and determined to denounce major candidates of other political parties for being slavishly dependent on the rich donors that keep their campaigns alive. Interesting economic comment from Mr. Trump. Next, Mr. Trump has made absolutely unambiguous he supports Social Security. He will continue or expand Medicare and Medicaid, something the other Republican candidates don't do. In fact, most of them are talking about cutting Social Security benefits, limiting or cutting Medicare or Medicaid or both of them. He is therefore appealing to the fact that the majority of Americans support Social Security, want to continue its benefits, ditto with Medicare and Medicaid. And he shows that that's the winning position, not just in the population as a whole, but among the more conservatives who make up the bulk of the Republican Party. And here's an interesting comment. Mr. Trump is now winning the majority of support from Tea Party folks. Now, the Tea Party has been proclaimed as a group that's against the government, that is libertarian in that sense. But it isn't, is it? Because it's switching over to a Mr. Trump who is celebrating the importance of the government in, for example, providing health care for everybody, providing Social Security benefits, and so on. Tea Party folks swinging over to a candidate who distinguishes himself by being pro-government on a whole host of issues. How interesting. What's that about? Well, it suggests that large parts of the Tea Party are really not against the government, whatever the media has made of what some of their comments suggest. The reality, as many of us suspected, is that the Tea Party folks are angry about who gets government support, not about the support itself. They want more support for themselves, even if it's at the expense of others. And as if to make the point most powerfully, let's talk finally about Mr. Trump and immigration. He has gotten probably more press on this than anything else. His determination to send the immigrants back, mostly to Latin America, seems to have picked on that particular part of the immigrant population. What is that about? Well, that's the same issue, isn't it? It's pandering to those people in America who want to believe that their economic problems at work, at the bank, in their homes, are somehow attributable to immigrants in this country. The evidence for that, slim to none. But it's a very popular way to unload some steam, to find a bad guy, a scapegoat, blame it on the immigrant. That's what's going on here. It's Mr. Trump realizing he's talking to very angry people who want more, not less, in the way of jobs, income, and yes, government services. But because it's hard to say that in this culture, they twist it around with Mr. Trump's help and make it an anti-immigrant. The government shouldn't be helping them. It should be helping Tea Party folks instead. That's Mr. Trump's argument, and that's why he's succeeding, because no one else is providing those people that he appeals to with an alternative solution to the problems they face, so they go with his for the lack of something better. And you see exactly the same displacement of people's upset and anger about their deteriorating economic situation being deflected into an anti-immigrant scapegoatism. You see it in virtually every European country, just as you have seen it historically in the past, when the standards of living, the job security of masses of people become attacked and diminished. That's the wave Mr. Trump is riding. That's the economics of his campaign. Finally and quickly, on September 8th, an historic event in Oakland, California, the city council there will pass a resolution actively supporting, endorsing, and helping worker co-ops to be developed in that very large and important California city. I want to salute what the folks in Oakland are doing, but also to underscore the importance. Most cities and towns, if they do anything called, quote, economic development, talk endlessly about jobs. What they don't talk about is what kind of jobs. But a job is not what most people want. A decent job, one that they can believe in, one that pays a decent salary, one that recognizes the dignity of work. That's what people want. And economic development should never have been just about jobs. We are learning that bitterly as a unionized job with benefits in a factory gives way to a non-unionized job with no benefits and haphazard hours in a fast food joint or a Walmart. Oakland is committing itself to worker co-ops, jobs where workers themselves have the power to make sure they get treated properly. Hats off to Oakland, California. Let me respond in the time we have left in the first half of our program to some of your questions. First one, very well put. Thank you. This is a fellow from Idaho. You ask, we've all been told that we should tighten our belts since the Great Recession began in 2008. Could you tell us whether we have indeed all tightened our belts? Have we indeed all shared in our economic problems? Have we indeed all recovered? Well, let me answer it as bluntly as I know how. It's a good question. It demands a straight answer. The answer is no, of course we have not. Those at the top, those who are the richest, those who had the most to do with bringing us the crisis, they have recovered. They haven't had to tighten their belts, oh, maybe a little, in 2009 and 10, but not since. They've done fine. Here's the statistic. In fact, I'll give you two statistics that drive the point home. I take the first one from the Economic Policy Institute, and you can find out all about their research. They do a lot in questions like this at their website, epi.org. I use their material from time to time. It's been reliable. I have no reason to doubt it. Here's their latest. The bottom 80%, 80%, 4/5 of American workers have seen their wages fall in the period 2007 to 2014. In other words, when everybody's belt needed to be tightened, the bottom 80% actually saw their belt tighten. They saw their real wages, that's the amount of money they got, adjusted for the prices they had to pay for the goods they bought with the money they earned. In other words, what they really could do in the way of consumption with their incomes. The bottom 80% saw their wage and salaries drop. But the upper 20%, the minority, the small minority of workers at the top, they didn't have to tighten their belt. They've seen their real wages and salaries go up. But now it's even worse. In a New York Times article, September 3rd, it shows that the workers at the bottom, the workers who get paid the least in our system, and there are tens of millions of them, are the ones who were required to tighten their belts, you guessed it, the most. Those who earned dividends and interest, people with wealth and property that brings them income, they did the best. The top 20% of wage earners have come out of the Great Recession, and they are no longer tightening their belts. They're loosening them. They're doing better. But the 80%, the vast majority, have seen their wages rise, and the poorest among them, have seen their wages fall, and the poorest among them have seen their wages fall the most. Capitalism has not only subjected us to another one of its unstable downturns, but in an exercise of the opposite of justice, it has cost those at the top the least and imposed the highest costs on those at the bottom. Capitalism is an unjust economic system, and never more so than in the aftermath of the crisis of 2008. Last question that we will have time for. few weeks ago, we spoke about the federal income tax and how it now depends chiefly on a progressive income tax. And by progressive, we simply mean the higher your income, the higher the percentage of it you have to pay. A little less than half of the federal government's money comes that way. The other half comes from a payroll tax, which is not progressive. Everybody pays the same percentage all the way up to about $120,000 a year, and then it becomes downright opposite of progressive, namely regressive, because if you earn more than $120,000 a year, all of the money you earn beyond that pays no Social Security or payroll tax whatsoever. So if you put all that together, and you add the little bit of excise tax and corporate tax, it turns out our federal tax system is not progressive at all. It basically taxes everybody more or less at the same rate. So people have said to me, well, what about state and local taxes? Because Americans are affected not just by the federal tax we pay to Uncle Sam, but likewise by the taxes we pay to the state governments, sales taxes, excise taxes, and so on, and the taxes we pay to local governments, property taxes above all. Well, something called the Institute on Taxation and Public Policy, ITEP, and I urge you to look at their website called itep.org. They do the research, and in their recent research, up to date for this year, here's what they showed to answer this question once and for all. The poorest 20% of Americans pay 11% of their income in state and local tax. The top 1%, the richest, pay 5.4% of their income in state and local taxes, less than half. You put federal, state, and local taxes together, and here's what you get. The richer you are, the lower the percentage of your income you pay in taxes. This is a tax system rigged against the middle and the poor and in favor of the rich. No two ways about it. We've reached the end of the first half of our program. Please stay with us. I think you'll find the second half an exciting foray into two major topics that will be of interest. We will be back in a very short number of seconds. Put your hand. Welcome back, friends, to the second half of Economic Update for this first week in the month of September 2015. In welcoming you back, I want to remind you that if this program is of interest to you, there's a great deal more of this kind of material available at the two websites that we maintain, rdwolf.com and democracyatwork.info. All one word, democracyatwork.info. Both of those websites contain materials, including whole classes in various topics, interviews on television and radio that I do, materials, articles written, all kinds of things that I think those interested in this program will find available. And of course, both websites are available at your convenience 24/7, no charge whatsoever. Let me invite you particularly to look at democracyatwork.info. It has just been renovated and is new in its appearance, and to ask you to sign up there for our free newsletter. It will be going out now much more often than it did in the past, a way for you to keep up in whatever degree you want with the activities we are engaged in. with my travels around the country. I want to remind you and correct the list I gave you last week. I inadvertently left out Houston, Texas, and I apologize for that. But everything in the next 2 to 3 months, including the following: Tampa, Florida region, Houston, Texas, Ames, Iowa, Kansas City, Missouri, Fresno, California, Seattle, Washington, Berkeley, California, and no doubt others that I will be reminded I did not mention and should have once this program is over. I also want you to go to our websites, because with a simple click, you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. This is another way to keep up with the work we do, including a good bit of it that does not have time to be aired on this program. And finally, a reminder that the second Wednesday of most months, I do a public talk at the historic Judson Memorial Church in New York City, at Washington Square, a famous part of downtown New York City. And you are invited. The church is open. The church welcomes people to come to these monthly talks. I have more of an opportunity there to develop the kinds of arguments you hear here. It's a chance also for you to meet me and for me to meet you. When we have time, we do a little bit of Q&A back and forth. So if you're interested, the next one is Wednesday, September 9th, 2015, 7:30 p.m., historic Judson Memorial Church on Washington Square in Manhattan. Well, this last week, one item has dominated the economic news, and so we're going to spend some time talking about it. We've had some wild days on Wall Street, the stock markets of the United States, the New York Stock Exchange, the NASDAQ, and so on, have bounced around with extreme 500-point movements in a single day, sometimes in the matter of an hour or two. And this followed gyrations in the Chinese stock markets and, indeed, similar extreme volatility in many other markets around the world. So the question is, what's going on? Why would suddenly investors, including hedge funds, big banks, wealthy individuals and corporations, be dumping stocks for fear, obviously, that the companies they've invested in are going belly up or going to lose money or going to collapse, who knows, and then changing their mind a day or two later and then rechanging it 3 days later? It's chaotic. It's disorganized. It's a mess. And the very volatility bouncing up and down has its effects. So let's see. What is going on? Well, I came up with a list, just to give you an idea, of six distinct anxieties in the world, any one of which could spook stock markets. But the combination of all six is certain to create serious downturns. And we're going to discuss them briefly, and then I'm going to draw the conclusions about an economic system that heads into this kind of chaotic volatility. But before I do, keep the following in mind. Nobody wants economies to collapse. Not just the mass of people who suffer the most in the first half of this program. We showed that. But even the people in the middle and even the people running the system don't want collapse, don't want this crazy volatility, are very afraid. Sure, there are a few market hustlers who play the volatility itself. They like it. But they are a tiny, tiny, tiny minority. Most everybody else is frightened. And if you read the financial press, you'll see it right away. So what do you say about a system where nobody wants what the system keeps delivering to all the people who don't want it? A rational society would begin to question a system that works that way. We don't want unemployment. We don't want jobs disappearing. We don't want bankruptcies. We don't want companies cutting back. But that's what market instabilities produce. So a rational society would have to question a system that produces what the vast, vast majority of people don't want and keeps doing it over and over again. And we will return to that when we're done with this discussion. First, there's the issue of China. What is going on in China? Well, the world knows that the Chinese economy is slowing down. We know it from the statistical studies done both by Chinese and non-Chinese specialists. We know it because the Chinese government admits it. And we know it because everybody else who watches and studies China sees the same thing. China has been growing at a great rate for 20 years, and it is now slowing down. And why? Well, the answer is, again, the way our system works. China developed industrially when it opened itself up, or let me put it differently, China's growth, economic growth, sped up. It was doing quite nicely before this, but it went faster when it opened itself up to multinational capitalist corporations from Japan, from Europe, from the United States, and so on, could go into China, welcomed by the Chinese government, and provided with all kinds of supports and subsidies, and above all, a relatively cheap labor force of Chinese workers. So what happened was company after company closed its factories, its offices, its stores in Western Europe, North America, and Japan, and moved to the more profitable locations inside China. When they did that, they didn't know exactly what other companies were going to be doing that in the same way. They wanted to capture as much of the world market for themselves as they could. So they didn't just set up factories in China to replace those they closed at home, but because it was cheaper and because they had high hopes to capture markets, they expanded the capacity to produce goods and services in China. So they were much larger than what had been the case in the Western Europe, North America, and Japan areas from which these companies moved. End result was, and this is so classic for capitalism, they overbuilt in China. That's right. Overcapacity. They built the ability. They created factories to produce more cars than there is a market for in the world. More radios, more televisions, more watches, more appliances, you name it, there's overcapacity in it, particularly in China, but secondarily in a lot of the other low-wage countries to which capitalist enterprises moved. The end result is that China moved hundreds of millions of its people off of the countryside, away from agriculture and the rural areas, into the urban industrial parts of China, telling them that great jobs awaited them in the industries that were being created, and boy, they were impressive, in the new cities springing up, and boy, they were and are impressive, because they could produce for the world market. What no one explained is, because they like to forget it, capitalism's constantly repeated experience, because it isn't planned, because it isn't coordinated, because each capitalist makes his or her own calculations for what they think is good for their own enterprise without regard for how it all fits together, they ended up producing more capacity than the Chinese have a market for. So guess what? They're having to close factories, to reduce factory hours, to lay workers off, and they're not therefore buying the raw materials the way they once did. Which means that the Chinese economy is slowing down. Chinese workers have less of an income with which to buy things. Even more interesting and scary, the raw materials that China was buying everywhere, iron ore, oil, gas, cotton, you name it, from many, many third world countries in the world, in Asia, Africa, and Latin America. The Chinese aren't ordering the quantities they did as little as 2 and 3 and 4 years ago. So the whole world economy is slowing down because of overinvestment and overcapacity creation, above all by private capitalist enterprises in China, above all else, and in other parts of the world. And that destabilizes stock markets and economies around the world. Number two, chaos in the oil markets. The United States is the culprit here. In the United States, vast amounts of money have been provided in kind by the U.S. government, permitting fracking and other mechanisms of bringing shale oil to the surface, Canada participating in this as well. Hundreds of billions have been lent to companies bringing the oil up, with the end result that the United States is now a major provider, producer, supplier of oil in the world. The demand for oil in the world hasn't shot up. It's held fairly steady. And with the economic downturn coming from the overcapacity in China that I just expressed, the demand for oil is going nowhere. But the supply went through the roof, above all because of the United States. If the supply of something goes sharply up, but the demand for it doesn't, then all of the extra supply is going to have a hard time finding anyone to buy it. And when that happens, the suppliers start competing with one another by dropping the price. That's why oil has dropped by more than half in its price per barrel over the last year. And what that does is destroy the economies that depend on oil. What are they? Russia, Venezuela, Nigeria, Iraq, Saudi Arabia. Each of them is having trouble, some more, some less, depending on how urgent their dependency was. But we don't stop with countries. The whole middle part of the United States, including Canada in the north, but all the way through the Dakotas on down to Texas, they're in trouble too, because that's where the new oil dumped on the world market by the United States comes from. There, tens of thousands have lost their jobs in the oil fields. Banks are in serious difficulty laying off people because the loans they made for this oil business are going bad. Here is a system that doesn't work very well, does it? In the midst of producing chaotic swings in oil, and that upsets all kinds of people. Countries that made tons of money off high oil prices and invested in the stock market, they're not making that money. They're not investing in the stock market. They're pulling back. They're selling stocks in order to take care of expenses because the money they earn from oil isn't there. That's roiling the stock markets, as we say. You see the problem. Third, again, the United States, this time the Federal Reserve. Ever since the crash of 2000, and especially the crash of 2008, the Federal Reserve has tried to support the United States economy to bring it out of its severe downturn that nobody wanted by doing two things, bringing interest rates down to nearly zero and pumping vast new amounts of money into the system. They're now afraid, of course, that that money, if at some point it starts to run after goods and services, will drive up prices. They're afraid of an inflation. And so to forestall an inflation, they're thinking of raising interest rates, maybe as soon as this month of September. But everybody knows that if they raise interest rates, it'll make it harder for people to borrow the money needed to buy cars, harder for people to borrow the money needed to buy homes. And that may downturn the economy even more. And it may make it very hard for countries around the world who borrowed lots of dollars in the United States because the interest rates were so low. So if the Federal Reserve raises them, the fear is other things could go really bad in the economy. So people already get out of the stock market, anticipate. You get the picture? Slowing in China, chaos in the oil markets, and anxiety over what the Fed will do. But now Europe and Japan are places that the economic crisis has not been even a little bit overcome the way it has in the United States. Japan has in another recession. Europe never got out of it. So they're not going to help. They're, in fact, troubled areas. And the sixth one, is the inequality in the United States. Economists are worried that American companies, like foreign companies, are going to discover in the months and years ahead, Americans cannot afford to buy the way they used to. The United States was once the engine of the world, consumers here buying so much, having so much expendable money that they could spend, that they kept the world humming. The Americans have been reduced. The middle class is gone. The working class is hemmed in at every turn. We've talked about this over and over again. The Americans can't drive the system with consumption. And so people are getting out of the stock market or very afraid and anxious because they wonder when the axe will fall of the lack of purchasing power as masses of Americans lose the ability to spend the way they once did. You put all these things together, China, the Fed, oil, Europe and Japan's stagnation, and U.S. inequality, and you have more than enough explanations for a stock market that is going crazy as it worries itself sick about what? About how capitalism can and always has experienced major downturns, meaning companies cut back, companies go out of business, masses of people are laid off. Those people want jobs, but they lose them. We want our industries humming, but they don't. We need the output to solve our social problems, but we don't get together to produce what we have the materials and the capacity to produce. This is a system whose innate instability stares us in the face as a screaming illustration of its inefficiency, its waste, and its failures. For the 250 years that capitalism has become the dominant system in the world, it has delivered to the people in it this regularly recurring instability, called the business cycle, called crises, called upturns, downturns, recessions, depressions, inflations, booms, busts. We have a lot of words for this thing because we never have been able to shake it. Every effort has been made by economists, political leaders, you name it, to come to some solution that would prevent these kinds of downturns. All efforts have failed. That's why we had another doozy in 2008, and that's why I could list all the kinds of crises I just did. This is a system who delivers to us instability that nobody wants, that the majority suffer from one way or another. And the only really interesting question is, why do we admit a system as unstable as this as somehow the only one we can have, when that's clearly not true, but even more amazing, as the best we can do? What a nasty comment on ourselves from people who say such things. The other big topic is socialism. I wanted to talk about socialism because it is becoming more and more of an issue. It's kind of coming out from the taboo that made it almost impossible to talk about, let alone to talk sanely about, for so many years in this country. That was, if you like, a casualty of the Cold War. Since our enemy, the Soviet Union, defined itself as the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, that's what USSR means, because they called themselves socialists, it became impossible for Americans to say the word without meaning something horrible, awful, evil, and barely mentionable. Well, all that's changing now, and I wanted to talk to you about it. There, first of all, is no reason to be surprised by the resurgence of interest in socialism. That has happened many times in the history of capitalism and shouldn't surprise anyone. Typically, it happens when capitalism stumbles, when capitalism doesn't deliver the goods, when capitalism looks increasingly to people to be a system that, if it ever served human society, has stopped doing so, when it looks as though capitalism is something we could and should do better than. And we live in such a period. Capitalism has really done terrible things to masses of people. That's what all this disappearing middle class and so on is all about. That's what the first half of this program documented yet again. So it isn't surprising at all that people begin to think of alternatives to a system that isn't working very well. And when you start thinking about that, you're going to hit socialism, because it's the biggest collection of criticisms of capitalism and of notions of an alternative to capitalism that we have. So the minute an open-minded, intelligent person begins to look for alternatives to capitalism, socialism is just a step away. So let's talk briefly about socialism. First, let me remind you, we now have a candidate for president, Bernie Sanders, who is, by self-definition and by general agreement, a socialist and has been all his adult political life. So here we are. The world hasn't caved in. Nobody has horns. Here he is, a socialist. Number two, we are an ally, pretty close ally, of the French government in France. The French government, the president, is the head of the Socialist Party of France. The National Assembly, which is like our House of Representatives, the dominant political party in the French House of Representatives, is the Socialist Party, and the number one party in the Senate of France, you guessed it, the Socialist Party. The government of Germany is, in effect, a coalition between the conservatives and the socialists, and that has been the case for a while. The Socialist Party in Germany was the government before Merkel, and on and on and on. Socialism is everywhere. Only the desire to pretend otherwise has kept this understanding from the American people. Number two. Capitalism came into this world, for example, in the French Revolution of 1789, making a promise. It would get rid of the slavery and the serfdoms that preceded it. Slavery and feudalism would be pushed aside for a new society in which employers and employees contracted together to produce goods and services as free men and women. Freedom. Indeed, the slogans of the French Revolution, let's remember, liberty, equality, fraternity. Slogans picked up in the various adjustments by Thomas Jefferson and the founders of the United States, and indeed of many other countries. The idea was that capitalism would replace the previous economic systems, and that that would mean, and that that would guarantee, equality, democracy, liberty, freedom, and so on. The problem has been from day one, and by day one I mean the 19th century and the 20th century, that wherever capitalism came, whatever it did, and it did many things, some of which were good, some of which were not so good, but what it did not do was bring equality and democracy. If by democracy you mean that everybody has an equal say, an equal power, if you like, to make the decisions for community life. If that's what you understand democracy to mean, and I believe that's how it's defined, then capitalism didn't produce that. We don't have that in the United States. And we can argue that we've gone further in democracy than many other countries. We don't have that. In the places where people work, let me remind you, You go to work in a company, a corporation, where a tiny group of people, major shareholders, owners, select a board of directors, 10, 20 people. They make all the decisions, what to produce, how to produce, where to produce, and what to do with the profits. Your job is to work there. Your job is to help produce the profits. But you are excluded from participating in deciding anything of importance in that business. That's not democratic, friends. That's undemocratic. And that's how capitalism works. So it brought a lot of things, good and bad. But democracy, it didn't bring. And I don't need to remind you that equality is not something capitalism brings. The last 30 years have been capitalism in America, for sure, and deepening inequality without hindrance. So why are we surprised if a system that comes into being as the guarantor and the deliverer of equality and democracy can't deliver what it promised and therefore invites people to think about alternative economic systems that might be better equipped to deliver the democracy and equality that capitalism couldn't deliver? That's why socialism is on the agenda again. And we will have opportunity to come back and talk about that in future programs. We've come to the end of our time. I want to thank you for listening. I want to thank truthout.org, that remarkable independent source of news and analysis, every day producing wonderful things to teach us about what's going on. Check them out at truthout.org. Again, take a look at our websites. They are there for your help, for your service, for your use anytime and every time at no charge. That's why we keep them up to date with new items added every single day. It's been a pleasure preparing and delivering this program, and I look forward to talking with you again next week. Change, change, change. Change, change.